This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company. It's winter. It's a bit of a chill in the air, depending on where you are across Queensland. And if you get a bit chilly, if you get a bit cold, I bet you just grab your coat, you put on a jumper, turn the heater on. That's not really possible for livestock, especially if you're a freshly shorn sheep. You don't have your jumper. And it can also be hard for graziers to prepare their animals for when cold spells come through. There's not always a lot of warning, and sheep and cattle may be in some pretty remote paddocks that are difficult to reach. But now there's a new tool to help manage livestock welfare. The Northern Australia Climate Program has developed a new prototype, Livestock Chill Index Forecast. It calculates potential heat loss in livestock by factoring in temperature, wind speed and rainfall. University of Southern Queensland research fellows Dr. Tim Cowan and Dr. Rachel Taylor explain how it works.
The Livestock Chill Index itself has been around since the 1970s, and it was developed for sheep in southern regions of Australia. And it was developed to describe the impact of cold conditions, chill conditions, when it's rainy and it's wintry, that effect on newly shorn sheep or lambs. So the Bureau have used this Livestock Chill Index for a number of years now to provide sheep graziers warning. And they're the warnings you might see on the news of night. But these are put out sort of a day or two in advance. And what we want to do is create an actual gridded forecast map showing the risk of livestock chill across the country. And that's what we've done, putting a map together which shows that risk going out to sort of 5 days in the future.
And Rachel, you were behind, I guess, the actual creation of it. How does it work?
The Livestock Chill Index takes input of the temperature, the rainfall, and the wind, because it's a measure of how quickly animals lose heat. The outside temperature, obviously, will impact that. It was designed for newly shorn sheep, so the rainfall, if that animal's coat is wet, they'll be losing heat more quickly due to that. And obviously the wind speed, you'll have that wind chill effect. So, yeah, it takes those inputs and creates this measure of how quickly an animal is losing heat energy.
And how can farmers use this data?
So we're providing forecast maps that are updated daily. So just say that there's a risk, say a moderate to high risk of livestock chill in the next day or two, then it might give farmers an opportunity to make decisions around their farm, where they may move their animals into shelter or to a more sheltered area. And it just gives you a greater awareness of the potential risk to their livestock. We should say that this is a forecast, so it doesn't necessarily mean what we predict will necessarily happen, but it just gives graziers a better idea of what's likely to eventuate in the next 2 to 3 days, aside from just knowing what the temperature and rainfall conditions will be.
The maps have thresholds that we've adapted just from what is standard for newly shorn lambs, but people looking at the forecasts will be able to see where there's low risk and then moderate, high and extreme risk. So they can use those thresholds to kind of refine their approach and make decisions on managing their livestock in those forecasted circumstances.
And Rachel, what about for cattle? Are the thresholds different?
We don't actually know that. The Livestock Chill Index has not been adapted for cattle, and no comprehensive assessment has been done on whether those thresholds are different.
So how does this differentiate between the current sheep graziers warnings that you could see on the Bureau of Meteorology's website?
Yeah, so the sheep graziers warning is really, really aimed at southern sheep farmers. And it only really goes out to 1 or 2 days in the future. So it's really specific to a given location or a given region. So these are forecast maps. I mean, many producers that we talk to, they're visual people. They like looking at maps, whether that's synoptic maps or temperature maps. So these give you a good idea of what the widespread conditions are going to be like out to, say, 5 days in the future. And what we tell producers that, look, you may see a system that's on the horizon in the next 3 or 4 days. The good thing to do is to go back to the forecast because they're continually updated. And so you'll have a better idea what's likely to come in the next day or two.
When, you know, you're looking at this and you're seeing that there's going to be a risk coming in a couple of days' time, what strategies can they actually take? Especially when you think about like a northern cattle property in particular, they're incredibly big. The cattle are grazing in very remote parts of the country. What would you do if you saw a warning coming?
We've talked to producers about this on the back of an extreme event that occurred in February 2019 when there were massive floods in the northwest of Queensland. And we spoke to sheep farmers in the town of Winton, and they were right on the edge of that monsoon depression. And what they said, what they did is they simply put out feed for their livestock. So we know that chill events, as Rachel said, it's about that loss, the potential loss of energy, so the loss of heat. So even just providing extra feed for their animals, if it's possible, that's one management strategy that can be put in place. It's true that for larger properties, it's tougher to make wholesale changes to your management strategy when you're talking, you know, hundreds of kilometres. But for those smaller scale properties, yeah, moving cattle into or sheep into a more sheltered region, supplying feed. Yeah, so it's just being more aware of what you could do to, I guess, somewhat mitigate the risk to your livestock.
This is where these extended range forecasts really shine, as opposed to the warnings that are put out officially, because just having that bit more foresight means that producers on those really large properties can take measures. We've also looked at chill events that happened in 2007 and one in 2021. We know that producers can take really valuable measures like moving their animals to just places with more, you know, tree cover, places that are likely to stay drier so that cattle aren't standing in mud or in even water. And particularly, I think, keeping an eye out for your animals that are at risk, you know, calves, young animals, sick animals, cattle that are already in poor condition, things like that.
When someone directs to this index, where do they find it, first of all, and what does it look like?
Yeah, so the forecasts are under the Northern Australian Climate Program webpage. That's nacp.org.au/cattle_thermal_stress_forecasts. So that's a bit of a mouthful. And you can go through, there's a number of different thermal stress forecast products there. They're all prototypes. Then they can click on the Livestock Chill Index, and what it'll show is maps of the daily conditions going out to 5 days. And the different colours represent, I guess, the extremeness or the level of risk to livestock. So the more yellow and orange and red are the colour, the more the risk there is posed to livestock.
So this is a prototype. What will you be looking at when financing it?
I think the next steps are we'll take this out in the extension work that we do as part of the program. And what we've done for other products is we gather feedback from producers, we find out what they like and what they dislike about the product, what can be improved, and we're always looking at ways of improving these forecasts, whether it be producers want a more sort of regionalized forecast, whether they want information specific to their location. So there's a number of things that we can do, but the first step is to let users basically use this product and let us know what they like, how we can improve it.
For our other prototypes on the website, there is an ability to look more closely at your regions. So Queensland and Northern Territory, you can zoom right in and it's got the locations of different towns, much more specific, like local government areas and stuff that you can look at. So I think that will be a really important thing to add to these forecast maps.
The Livestock Chill Index is just one product we have on our Northern Australian Climate Program thermal stress forecast page. So there are other ones there that are more specific to cattle, like the Cattle Comfort Index, which is a measure of more like the feel-like temperature cattle. So it covers both heat and chill. So these products are really complementary. So if you have one which is showing sort of the conditions out for the next 7 days, then you can use that and then look at how, say, the livestock chill index is changing. So they're a good way to sort of get a more comprehensive picture of the weather conditions for the next sort of 5 to 7 days.
We've done research that really shows that especially the livestock chill index and the cattle comfort index are really complementary, as Tim said, and show just sort of different aspects of potential cold conditions. So, yeah, really important to take into account all of the information you can get when you're looking at those forecasts, and also remembering that they are a prototype and a forecast, making decisions based on all of the information you can gather and not just one or two sources.
University of Southern Queensland Research Fellows Dr. Tim Cowan and Dr. Rachel Taylor. It is 18 minutes past 12.
Young people are the lifeblood of a thriving community.
The ABC is looking for trailblazers, 18 to 28, with a drive for making change in their regional communities.
Applications close August 3.
abc.net.au/trailblazers.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
The world's largest sugar producer, Brazil, is expecting a 50% tariff on all their exports into the United States to kick in on August 1st. So the US already has quotas on sugar imports in place. So while this new tariff won't mean a huge amount of sugar dumped on the world market, there's still concern it'll impact global trade confidence. Australian sugar manufacturers CEO Ash Saladini explains to Liam McNally.
Let's see if it actually comes to fruition and it doesn't change in 2 weeks' time. But what it actually does is the uncertainty, regardless of whether America goes through with it, it just whittles away the confidence in free trade globally. And it's a huge issue for the Australian sugar industry as well. For example, we do have two or three shipments maybe to the US. If, you know, we were hit with a significant tariff, then how do you sort of with certainty know next year that whether you want to do those two or three shipments? Will India follow suit? Will Brazil follow suit? And this really whittles away, that certainty around international markets and supply, but two, in investment. You know, when you're making multi-billion-dollar investments in an industry, you hope that there's some certainty around supply, whether it's sugar or biofuel. So as tariffs are sort of being erected. Countries are now reaching for things like domestic protections, domestic subsidies, and that's going to hugely impact us. So, for example, India subsidizes their sugar at some rate of around 100% of cost of production, and now they're going to start to export again, despite the fact that there's a WTO ruling against it for having domestic protections that are against WTO rules. And that's going to really have a downward impact on global sugar prices. Prior to this sort of trade war, sugar prices were probably closer to 20 cents. Now they're getting closer to 15 cents per pound. So that's a huge drop in price. The other fear is that countries will start erecting their own barriers, and we are sort of 90% export-orientated industry. So it's a profound impact on the Australian sugar industry. And the only way forward is us working with government to have a industry policy around what we want to do, whether it's biofuels, sugar, bioenergy, because once you lose that sort of industrial capability, it's very hard to get it back.
Do you expect that to continue falling at all?
It doesn't look like it's bouncing back. Again, in the long term, we hope it does bounce back because there is a sort of growing demand for sugar and sugar products. But in the short term, I can't see it bouncing back.
How does that impact farmers, millers, like producers along the supply chain?
Well, it's going to be, I dare say, it's not going to be a profitable year. That's the first point. I think there is not really any margin to be had this year. And it's coming off a year where we've had a lot of challenges. So we've had floods, we've had cyclones. And so we've already had a very costly year. And now the revenue looks like it's not going to be there either. So it's a tough year. But this industry knows how to deal with tough. And again, over the long term, with the right government policies, with things like trying to diversify into new markets like biofuels, and with the government support, we're definitely going to be a growing industry for the next decade or two.
When did India announce it was going to start exporting again?
So last year they announced they're going to hand out export certificates to sugar manufacturers, and this year they're predicting a 3 to 5 million ton sugar surplus. And to put that into context, at the upper range, that's about what we make in total. So not what we just export, that's the total Australian market that they're suggesting they want to export.
Yeah, wow. And is that a reaction to American trade war stuff? How does that all link up?
I think it's a reaction to the fact that the global institutions around free trade have become weakened. So if America it does not abide by them, why should India? And I think they've been emboldened to thumb the nose of organisations like the WTO and its rulings.
Australian sugar manufacturers CEO Ash Saladini. Now, in 2019, Australia, Brazil and Guatemala lodged a formal complaint against India to the World Trade Organization, saying its government was subsidizing its sugar industry and it caused a glut in the international market, leading to a significant drop in global prices. And 2 years later, the WTO ruled in favor of the complainants. Commodity analyst Tom McNeil says recently India has been diversifying its feedstock for ethanol, which raises concerns that the leftover sugar will return to the international market.
In the year just finishing, 24-25, India's actually run a deficit and they've drawn down stocks. So they didn't import from the global market, but neither did they export. In the year that's coming, we see production potentially around 35 million tonnes, which would leave an enormous surplus if it was all made into sugar. It would be somewhere of the order of 6 to 7 million tonnes of sugar available. But the ethanol program in India will absorb some of that surplus. So our current thinking is that around 4 million tonnes of sugar equivalent will be made into ethanol. That will allow around 1 million tonnes of exports, maybe a little bit more. The wrinkle in the equation is that if India does not devote 4 million tonnes of sugar equivalent into ethanol, then more sucrose becomes available to export as sugar to the global market. And sugar in this situation where there is a surplus and prices are relatively low can only come out onto the global market at less than the cost of production in India. So India's cost of production is somewhere around 22 cents a pound. The current market's at 16.5. So you can see there's a wide gulf there between the world market price, which is reflecting a surplus, and what India can produce sugar for. So why should a country that has to take a loss on its exports or have government subsidies to make those exports remunerative to the Indian millers be allowed to just shove them out onto the global market? Well, that, and I guess that's the essence of the case that Australia, Guatemala and Brazil took to the WTO back 4 or 5 years, and the WTO ruled in the other exporter's favour. India would be going back on that whole agreement. I mean, it never fully accepted that that was a ruling against them. They wanted to appeal, but there's no appeal court currently in the WTO. Yes, I think that's a huge risk for the world market, that India sees fit to export more sugar onto the global market over the next year or so and keeps the world market at very low levels, lower than cost of production for efficient exporters like Australia, Brazil and Guatemala, for instance. You know, I guess it's a matter of wait and see. The entire global trade situation at the minute, with the US slapping tariffs on various countries at various levels, at various timings, is very unpredictable currently. And I guess, whereas, previously the US was seen as a rather steady trading partner for most countries, at the minute, things are much less predictable. And I think, the president likes it that way. But the implications of high tariff levels, changing tariff levels, the demands of tariffs, the demands built on other things other than just straight trade, it's become a very fraught environment out there. And I suspect some countries are seeing it as, well, the world order on trade has broken down somewhat, so there's less likelihood of there being restrictions and a need to abide by previous rulings of the WTO. I mean, I'd hope that that's not the case, but it's certainly the current trade environment is leaning that way.
Commodity analyst Tom McNeil speaking to Liam McNally. Now, just keeping with trade for a little while longer, because US President Donald Trump has unexpectedly floated a new baseline tariff for the world, which he says would likely be between 15 and 20%. That means Australian products could be hit with double the current 10% tariff. Now, the president hasn't named Australia in his comments, but the federal government says it'll continue to push for the removal of all US tariffs. It is 27 minutes past 12. Next, is it time to rethink food security in light of these trade disruptions? And later, I'll chat to the Bureau of Meteorology with all the details for the weather.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
The cuts to US aid projects and trade barriers by the US Trump administration could have disastrous consequences for global food security and agriculture innovation and development. Now, this comes as a new US initiative launches called the Food Leadership Security Council. And this council says they will strengthen US leadership to help solve global hunger. And it's urging a rethink on how to address hunger and food production systems. But Sean Coffey, the CEO of the Crawford Fund for Food Security, says the disruption to trade has a wide-ranging impact and it's actually making food less affordable.
In a broad sense, the US tariffs and shifting aid policies are creating significant uncertainty. They're starting to disrupt food security by leading to volatility in commodity prices, for example, reducing and changing market access. And also in many cases, even in the United States, making food imports less affordable. Those policies are also challenging many of the multilateral cooperation frameworks that we've been operating under the last 2 to 3 decades that have led to a significant improvement in food security. But what's happening now, I think, is we're going to see a slowing in agricultural innovation, particularly in vulnerable areas, as we disrupt, for example, the flow of information and agricultural research.
And what's being done about that on a global level?
Well, at this stage, we're still starting to actually identify the full impact of the changing tariff and aid policies and quite frankly, changes to the whole rules-based world trading environment. It's unlikely we're going to see a return to the stability of our systems even 12 or 18 months ago, but I think we increasingly will see the emphasis moving to identifying what's worked well in the past and working out how we can design that into systems of support for food and nutrition globally as we move forward. The people most in need of the support to allow them to develop the capacity to feed and clothe themselves, they're the ones that suffer enormously. But there's also significant impacts in other parts of the world too, particularly with distortions in trade and stability issues which impact on regional bases.
The Food Leadership Council last week made a statement or launched an initiative about the way that the world can eliminate, I guess, hunger and malnutrition. What was that statement about and what did it aim to do?
The Leadership Council has identified rightly that hunger is still a major problem throughout the world, and that has implications for defence and stability and regional prosperity. And what they've done is they've called for a complete rethink as to how we deliver food and achieve food security on a global basis.
Now, it was launched by Dr. Carey Fowler, who's the US Special Envoy for Global Food Security. Who is that and what kind of role does he have in this statement?
Carey was the US Special Envoy for Food Security. He's now left that position as it's been disestablished, and he's established a group of prominent international professionals under the Food Security Leadership Council, and their mandate is in fact to look at how we can readdress global hunger and malnutrition and how we can achieve more global stability and open trade.
How much impact will this really have, though, in a world where it seems nations are focusing more on the issues within their own boundaries or borders rather than what's happening internationally, particularly led by US government, who is very much saying we don't want to fund things outside of our country? Do you think this statement has a chance?
I think in the longer term it certainly does. What it's calling for is a recognition that the fundamentals of many of the problems we face are global. They're not contained behind borders. Things like climate change, widespread global soil degradation, water scarcity and water pollution, and those types of issues. And it also addresses the fundamental issues that hunger can lead to conflict, and you get trade distortions if you operate on a strict bilateral basis as opposed to multilateral.
That's CEO of the Crawford Fund for Food Security, Sean Coffey, speaking to Emma Field. I'll have all the details on the weather up next with the Bureau of Meteorology.
Before the sun rises, your local ABC team are starting their day getting ready to help you start yours. We're here to inform you as to what's happening with local news and events. ABC Breakfast, weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
And it's time to have a check-in on the weather, and Harry Clark joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Harry.
Good afternoon, Megan.
So it seems like it's going to be another unsettled week across Queensland. There's some rain about today.
Yeah, look, it certainly is. So we do have a weak cloud band that's stretching from the northwest around Mount Isa down to around Longreach and into the Maranoa and Warrego. It is bringing a fair bit of cloud, but only very light and patchy shower activity, mainly south of Longreach. So overnight, 2.6 millimetres at Windora was the top four out of that. Probably more notable is that it has kept those maximum temperatures fairly cool through the Maranoa and Warrego. Charleville currently sitting around 12 degrees at the moment. But elsewhere outside sort of that western Queensland area, it's a very settled day, quite sunny as well, not particularly warm unless you're in the far north, with temperatures in the low 30s for the Gulf Country and Peninsula at the moment.
Mm. What about in the coming days? It sounds like there's more rain in other parts of the state.
Yeah, certainly so. So as we go into tomorrow, we do see that a weak patchy cloud band and shower activity move into the Central Highlands and Coalfields, Wide Bay and sort of southern Capricornia region. Only millimetres at best falling out of it, indeed in southeast Queensland as well. Also some isolated showers continuing about the north and far north Queensland coast. Once again, very light. But it is sort of a prelude to a more significant system that will begin to develop across the sort of central west, northwest and far north from Thursday. So that's another cloud band with some more scattered to widespread, mostly light shower activity streaming in from the northwest. So places like Mount Isa could see a few millimetres in the gauge, true for Longreach as well, Winton, and also further east around Townsville, Ingham area. But it really is into Friday we do see that system shift east quite quickly and thicken up quite substantially. So areas east of Hughenden down to around Emerald, and across to Bundaberg, certainly looking at a fairly wet Friday, particularly areas near the coast, those coastal districts, likely to see sort of 15 to 20 millimetres falling out of that rain band. Areas inland, such as the Central Highlands, are more like 5 to 10, but still a notable given we are in July and this seems to be what, the third or fourth sort of rain-bearing cloud band we've had from the west in as many weeks.
Yeah, definitely seems to be quite a rainy winter. I want to go to the Channel Country now, just to check in on the fire danger. It looks like there's another high fire danger in the area.
Yeah, that's correct. We do have some high fire danger in the Channel Country. It's largely been driven by dry air rather than hot temperatures. We do have a bit of a stiff westerly breeze as well out there today. So not as significant as the other day. And if anything, we'll see those fire dangers drop off further as we go throughout the week, thanks to an intrusion of a very cold air mass behind that significant rain band I was mentioning on Thursday and Friday. So under the rain band, obviously, we'll see those temperatures quite depressed. We will see maximum temperatures really struggling to get to 20 degrees for much of North Queensland on the Friday. And then behind it, a very, very cold bout of air, probably amongst the coldest we've had so far this season. So looking at very low maximum temperatures right throughout Queensland, even the far north over the weekend.
Now, while all this is happening, what's happening in the coastal waters?
Yeah, for the moment, not too much is happening in the coastal waters. So we have a very weak ridge of high pressure along the Queensland coast. So for sort of the central and northern and far northern waters, generally northeast to southeast, around 10 to 15 knots, getting up to 15 to 20 knots for Cooktown and Peninsula waters. In the southeast, we have got a westerly wind regime in place, around 10 to 15 knots as well. So all fairly light along our coastal waters. Not a huge amount of change over the next few days. The only exception will be the southeast coast. We will see another bout of sort of stronger westerly winds on Thursday, up to 25 knots possible, but still no strong wind warnings expected in the next 3 days.
And with all these cold temperatures, there is some sunny days. So does that mean there's going to be some frost around parts of the state this week?
Yeah, certainly so. So it's certainly a bit of a seesaw in terms of those temperatures with the cloud coming through and then the colder air behind it. Really, we did see a fairly cold morning across the southern interior this morning. -2 at Oakey was the coldest in the state, tied with Kingaroy. Tomorrow morning, likely to be warmer for most other than far western Queensland, but even then, not cold enough really anywhere for frost. But certainly from Thursday, we will see some patchy frost return to the southern and central interior. and for Western Queensland as well on Friday. But looking at extensive frost, it'll really be Saturday onwards that we'll start seeing that frost risk extend quite broadly across the interior of the state, even into the northwest, well and truly. And by the time we get to Sunday morning, I don't think we could completely rule out some frost as far north as the Atherton Tablelands. Very dry air mass will be spreading across and into the far north for, you know, it's really struggled to do that so far this season. So amongst the coldest mornings so far this year for places like Cairns and up on the Atherton Tablelands.
Mm. Yeah, so from Saturday onwards, if there's like a bit of a widespread risk of frost, that's less showers next week?
Yeah, certainly so. So once this system mostly moves out to shore on out to sea on Saturday, we do see much drier conditions across the state. The exception will be the Darling Downs and Granite Belt. We are expecting some showers to drive in from the southwest on Saturday in particular. Essentially, we have a low that's developing off the New South Wales coast and some showers wrapping around that, and on the sort of northwestern flank, some of those will make it into the Granite Belt and Darling Downs on Saturday. But beyond that, a very dry early next week. Should also mention with those showers on Saturday in the Granite Belt, the snow level will be quite close to probably getting onto the very highest peaks of Girraween National Park. So a very cold air mass in place with those showers as well. I think parts of the Granite Belt will struggle to make double digits throughout the day on Saturday's maximum temperature.
Harry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much.
Harry Clark, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
Don't fight the static. Hear ABC local radio crystal clear on the ABC Listen app. Download now.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Every year, right across Australia, farmers, growers are spending billions of dollars trying to control weeds in their crops. So Hort Innovation, which is a grower-owned not-for-profit R&D company, has been looking overseas for solutions to save time and money and just cut down on the chemical use on farm. It's been working with a Swiss-based company that uses artificial intelligence-powered computer software to distinguish between the plants they do and don't want. Jose Marchietti from Ecorobotics spoke to Jennifer Nichols.
Our machine is an ultra-high-precision sprayer, and we spray basically plant by plant. So farmers can do very precise, efficient applications of phytosanitary products, plant by plant, and they can do both weeding treatments or crop protection treatments, saving up to 95% of the chemicals they are using on the fields, increasing the yields, protecting the environment, protecting the soil.
How difficult was it to develop the technology that could recognise the difference between, say, lettuce and the plant next to it, which in this case you'd consider a weed? At all of its stages of growth.
So the company started officially in 2014. We have a huge database recorded of plants worldwide, and we incorporated all this database into very smart algorithms that help with artificial intelligence. They are in a very quick 1/4 of a second understanding everything that it is on the field, differentiating the crops from the weeds, and then the farmer can choose to target one or the other. On the crop, you can spray fungicides, insecticides, foliar fertilizers, biostimulants, any product that could improve the yield and the health of the crop very precisely, plant by plant.
So 500 of those machines now operating around the world.
So we have 550 more or less between Europe and the US, and here we are very happy to give you the news that we have about 20 coming to the country, and around 6 are already sold. So we are super excited and happy that the market is welcoming this technology. We know the farmers all around the world are struggling mainly with manual labor, scarcity and the costs are going up every time. The cost of all the phytosanitary products, they are using more and more, and at values that are really making them struggle economically. So we are really bringing with a tool to solve one of the most important problems that farmers are facing in Australia and all around the world.
How expensive is this technology, and how soon would you see a return on your investment?
It's very affordable. The price of the machine is around 500,000 Australian dollars, but the interesting thing to understand is that the value we bring is much, much higher than that. And the return on investment is normally expected to be in 1 to 3 seasons, depending on the size of the operations. The big value we bring is in the big reduction on the inputs or phytosanitary products applied, plus the reduction on the need of manual labor, because you can enter into the field with certain products at certain stages that facilitates to clean up the fields with no manual labor needed. And the third big benefit is that many of the selective herbicides applied on the crops are knocking down the crops and decreasing the potential natural yield. By avoiding spraying the crop with these herbicides and focusing only on the crop, on the wheat, sorry, there's a yield increase to be expected. So,
and how does it operate over the field? Like, what does it look like?
The machine is pretty simple. It's a 6-meter sprayer divided in 3 modules with 156 nozzles separated 4 centimeters from each other. It has 2 tank systems, one for the mixture that is going to be applied, one for clean water to flush the machine at the end of the day. And it can be towed by a 70, 75 horsepower tractor easily. Very light machine, simple to operate. We provide a very friendly user face, so easy to introduce into any operation.
And so at this stage it's being towed?
At this stage it's being towed. We have many things for the future.
And what happens with repairs? If you have a breakdown, it's high tech, how do you deal with that?
Well, we have a business model that partners with dealers locally. So we already have a partner here in Australia, which we are very proud to be working with. And we provide all the training, spare parts, everything, so they can support their customers, our customers, properly and with the right timing. I mean, for us, it's a worldwide business model to go through local distributors or dealers.
Jose Machete from Acorobotics speaking to Jennifer Nichols.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app.
It is 13 minutes to 1. Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. Well, the AFL's newest team set to join the comp in 2028 is the Tasmania Devils. And you might be wondering why I'm talking about the AFL on the Queensland Country Hour, no less. Well, the Devils are collaborating with the Woolmark Company to produce an Australian-made woolen jumper for their fans, and it'll be made in Victoria. Larissa Smith spoke to Managing Director of Woolmark, John Roberts, about the opportunities and challenges switching synthetic material for high-performance wool in elite sport.
We've been working on the fibre of football for near on a decade now, and it's a big part of what we try to do is instill some confidence and some understanding that, you know, Australian wool has been a key part of our culture and our being for a long time, as has football. And we see this as a beautiful marriage, and we've done it with a number of different clubs over the years. But we see Tasmania as producing some of the most magnificent merino wool in the world. And this is yet another iteration of trying to show that, showcase that. So to one, make sure supporters are warm when they're on the sideline, but also proud that they're wearing locally produced product.
Why aren't AFL players wearing sports wool?
Oh, look, I think it stems back to, you know, a perception as much as anything, you know, and price. You know, traditionally wool was one of the prominent fibres that was available in the marketplace. But with the advent of synthetic fibres, which are much cheaper, much more competitively priced, I think that was probably a more attractive option for a lot of club franchises over the years. What's changing now is that people are gravitating away from synthetics because they know they're not good for the environment. And we're seeing a bit of a resurgence now in people wanting to use wool and promote its functional attributes, you know, which is shape retention and everything else.
And because you have back studies to show that sports people wearing wool use less energy to maintain, you know, their thermal heat. What are you doing in terms of talking to the AFL about changing not only the players wearing sports wool or wool jerseys, but also when it comes to woolen merchandise? That's all acrylic. All those scarves, they get manufactured in China.
Yeah, look, it's a constant. It eats at me every day. You know, having worked in the wool industry my whole life, you know, and knowing the benefits, it's one of those things that we are, as a company, determined to do, which is educate consumers, educate retailers, educate clubs, educate schools, that they should be putting their players, their children, in good natural fibres that perform well and last longer. What are we doing? We're arming those people with the literature and the science that can validate that and actually illustrate to them that it's the right thing to do. And ultimately, it's economically, you're better off too because it lasts longer. So, yeah, all those functional attributes that wool has, moisture management, odour management, shape retention, that's what we're trying to arm people with so they can make an informed decision about what they use.
Arming is one thing, but getting that message across the line so it translates into sales, into selling more wool, not only overseas but domestically. What's AWI doing to encourage and support more local manufacturing of woolen fibres?
The first part of your question I'll address first, which is, you know, what are we doing in terms of promoting the fibre? Well, the fibre of football and what we're doing with the Tassie jersey is exactly, you know, a great example of that. And we've used, you know, great advocates like Matt Fyfe, Tom Hawkins, Paddy Cripps, Bernie Vince, and now the Tasmanian Football Club to promote that and create the awareness is one point, and getting those people to talk and advocate for the fibre. In terms of overseas, which is where 99% of the wool is sold, we align with key influential brands, whether they be in fashion or sports, to actually change people's perceptions about wool and let them understand on the sustainable credibility of wool in terms of its eco-credentials, but also its drape and all the other wonderful things it brings to the fashion sector. But also in terms of manufacturing in Australia, look, we've done a feasibility study on what it would be like to onshore wool processing back in Australia. Right now the numbers look challenging, but it's certainly something we've looked at in the past.
So the numbers look challenging. Is that where you're going to pull up with that, or do you think there's scope to promote private investment in the sector? Is there just some pushback there when it comes to textiles?
Well, it's the size of the prize. I mean, you can't make people invest in markets if they don't see a benefit. Reality is to early stage process wool in Australia is still expensive relative to other markets. China's not as cheap as it used to be. We're now seeing a lot of wool processing move away from China into other markets. We've done a feasibility study on trying to bring it back to Australia, and right now the numbers don't stack up. Unless of course you get some sort of government subsidisation, which is another discussion.
Imagine what you could do for the wool industry if you sold tens of thousands of Australian-made scarves rather than acrylic.
It's not through lack of trying, I can assure you. We try and give people. I mean, wool is expensive. We know that. We've got to give people a reason to buy it or incorporate it into their products. And right now, if that erodes their margins, they often gravitate away from it. However, if you can actually convince the consumer that they're better off buying a wool garment in the longer term, it's a bit like the Rolex watch scenario. You buy it once, but it lasts you a lifetime. It's something you hand on to your next generation. So that's kind of the mentality or the mantra we're trying to promote.
John Roberts, CEO of Australian Wool Innovation and Managing Director of the Woolmark Company, speaking to Larissa Smith. Now, before I head to the markets, I just want to tell you about this amazing thing that's happening in northwestern Queensland, because the Mount Isa Rodeo is about a week away from kicking off, and there's some creative ways the Mount Isa Rodeo Queen entrance. Some things that they're doing to raise money for Outback charities. Kalpu and Yabbies are among them. Five Queensland ladies are competing for the crown, finding unique ways to rattle the tins. Here's Maddie Nixon with more.
I'm just ringing to let you know, this morning I did my Moopoo Lotto and you are the lucky winner.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
Wow, that's amazing. The day I'm having, I think you just made it.
Amy Kewen is a contestant in the Mount Isa Rodeo Queen Quest 2025 and is raising money in a unique way.
So the Moopoo Lotto is a version of a live hundreds board. So we map out 100 squares on the ground with spray paint, then bring in some beasts. This morning we used roping steers and they potter around wherever they want to go, and then wherever the first poo lands is the winner.
There are five entrants in this year's Queen Quest, competing to wear a crown at this year's rodeo, who have been raising cash for not-for-profit organisations.
I'm raising money for the Queensland Country Women's Association, specifically the Mount Isa branch. They're an organisation extremely close to my heart. My great-grandma, my namesake, was in the QCWA, my grandma, again in Cloncurry, and now my mum, locally here. So I'm fourth generation, and I knew that they were in extreme financial hardship. So I just thought that this was my opportunity to give back.
Two queens will be crowned. Whoever fundraises the most is dubbed the Charity Queen, with the overall winner becoming the Mount Isa Rodeo Queen. Both receive a tiara, buckle and sash.
I don't think there's one mould that fits any particular stereotypical rodeo queen, if you will. It is what you make it. You know, there's five of us this year and each of us is so individual and so different, and as long as you have a heart that is willing to give and someone who needs to be a little bit strong-minded, it's not easy all the time.
Amy isn't the only potential rodeo queen getting creative. Chloe Cabfell and Crystal Wright are also vying for the crown and have teamed up to deliver a race that stops crustaceans.
A Yabby race is a classic bush fundraiser, so think horse racing but with yabbies. You place them in the centre of a circular track and then they scurry to the outside, and then the first yabby to the outer edge wins.
Before the race, the yabbies are auctioned off. The highest bidder for each yabby is dubbed the jockey. The jockey whose yabby wins receives half the auction money, the other half going to the ladies' chosen charities.
I'm raising funds for the Mount Isa Hospital Auxiliary, and Crystal is raising funds for the Rural Fire Brigade Mount Isa. I chose the Hospital Auxiliary because everyone needs a hospital in their life. I've been fortunate enough to birth three of my babies at this hospital, plus receive care over my whole life.
As for the yabbies who don't win...
They definitely could eat them. They are good eating. If not, they might take them home, put them in their fish tank maybe.
Regardless of who wins the crown, all the potential queens will be checking out the shoots at this year's rodeo.
I personally have gone to nearly every rodeo in Mount Isa since I was born. The Mount Isa rodeo this year is back in community hands and it's going to be bigger and better than ever. I love it.
That story by Maddie Nixon. And it's time to have a look at the markets. Let's first cross to the Roma store sale with David Friend.
A very frosty Tuesday where Roma agency added reduced numbers to 7,290 head. Or the regular process of feline background is present and inactive with two to three extra southern operators. At the time of this interim report, the market dear for all categories. Yearling steers under 200 kilos topping at 5.35 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 200 to 280 kilos sold from 360 to 496 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos made to 482. Yearling steers 330 to 400 improved, with the majority selling from 390 to 433 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 400 to 480 kilos made to 418 to feed. Growing steers at 500 to 600 kilos sold to 415. And growing steers over 600 kilos to 420 cents a kilo. This has been David Friend from the National Livestock Reporting Service at Roma.
And Trevor Hess is watching the prices at the Warwick sale yards today.
Good afternoon. Rain across the general supply area reduced the number of cattle at Warwick down to 391 head. Overall quality of the young cattle was very mixed, and only a handful of cows and a few heavy grown steers and bullocks were penned. A fair panel of buyers were in attendance, have not all operated due to the short supply. Light weight yearling steers returning to paddock meet to 464 to average from 432 to 440. Yearling steers to feed for domestic market meet to 442 and average from 397 to 410. Medium weight yearling steers to the local trade market meet to 429, some heavyweights meet to 436. Lightweight yearling heifers to restockers meet to 358 to average 331. Medium weight yearling heifers to the trade meet to 394, the feeder portion meet to 370 to average 330. Bullocks mate to 392 to average 372. A single full mouth bullock mate to 305 to return $3,036. The short supplier cows mate to 318 to average 317. Heavyweight bulls mate to 330. This has been Trevor Hess from MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
And that's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. My name's Megan Hughes. News is up next. It's 1 o'clock.